Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Today on the podcast, we've got Matt Hall, a third-generation pilot, a former Royal Australian Air Force fighter combat instructor, and now an international unlimited acrobatic competitor. And Matt was the first Australian to be selected to compete in the Red Bull Air Race, with his rookie year being 2009.
Now, Tim, you and I have always looked at Tim Robertson as a chronic overachiever, someone who can always sort of outdo us in any field of endeavour. Now, when Robbo refers to someone as a natural, then we stand up and pay attention. And he did just that. He referred to Matt Hall as a natural pilot in the episode that we recorded with him.
And then got an opportunity to go to fighters. So it was kind of a progressive thing as I built my aviation expertise. I definitely wasn't a natural. I wasn't a Matty Hall by any stretch of the imagination, and certainly struggled through fighters as well.
This guy is obviously next level.
Now, the other lovely thing is that it makes Tim Robertson look like a chronic underachiever,
which we also enjoy.
So the Red Bull Air Race features the world's best racing pilots. It's a motorsport competition where these aircraft fly at speeds of between 400 and 450 kilometres an hour, enduring forces of up to 12 times gravity as they navigate a slalom track that's marked by 25 metre high air-filled pylons. Let's get on with the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I'm joined, as always, by my faithful co-host, Tim.
G'day, Ben.
And Tim and I are very fortunate to be joined by Matt Hall. Matt, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you guys?
Really well. Now, Matt, before we kick off the discussion proper, I wanted to do a bit of an audio association activity. I reckon we're about the same age. We haven't met, but I reckon we're about the same age. I want to play you a song, and if you could let me know the very first thing that comes to mind when you hear it. You ready?
Yep. Going fast.
Going fast.
I love it. As I mentioned, I reckon we're about the same age. I reckon that movie would have come out at a pretty formative time for you. Top Gun, was it an influence in your career choice?
It was, I probably wouldn't say it was an influence, like a large influence, but it definitely gave me some vision about that, you know, people actually fly these jets. Because I guess up until that point, you know, when you're a young kid and you're interested in aviation, if you see a jet fighter, it's hard to actually associate that there's a human being in that aircraft. You're sort of just watching this plane, this monster of an aircraft fly around, and it's like a machine. And Top Gun, for me, what that did was put it in perspective that it's actually just normal people flying these planes, and maybe I can be one of those people.
It's super interesting you say that. We've had a number of guests who've spoken about these things that from the outsider's perspective look sort of superhuman. Like a fighter pilot to me still is this amazing sort of vocation, probably because of my Top Gun formative years. But you're right, it is just normal people that put their mind to achieve something and actually get on and do these incredible things.
Exactly right. And that's one of the big lessons in life I've worked with is that, and I push to people is that if something can be done by any human being, there's no reason why you can't do it as well.
So Matt, we know you started flying at a very early age, and we understand that there's some flying through the generations in your family. Could you talk about your background and what inspired you to fly and then join the Air Force and then life beyond the Air Force?
I can put a quick summary of that one. It's so basically. Yeah, my granddad was a pilot in World War II. My dad was then a private pilot, and I used to fly with my dad. From the time I was knee high, the main type of flying my dad was doing was actually towing gliders at a gliding club, because that's free flying for the tug pilot. So I used to ride in the seat of the tow plane going up and down with him. And then when I turned 14, I actually started my formal training in gliders and ended up at 15 going solo in gliders, which was the cheapest form of flying for me to do. My dad ended up then purchasing an ultralight aircraft, and he taught me to fly that. So that was also pretty cheap to basically two-stroke fuel. My dad would let me fly it for just putting fuel in it. And then I took up hang gliding as well, because I'd borrow someone's hang glider and just jump off a cliff, and that was basically free. I was then able to combine all my hours and very efficiently do get a private pilot's license with minimal hours based on my previous experience. And then I started towing gliders as well as a 17-year-old. So I was doing, condensed a lot of flying into my early years, but did it financially efficiently because we didn't have a lot of money to be throwing at aviation.
So cumulatively, how many hours do you think you've spent either in a cockpit of a glider, ultralight, hang glider, F-18, or life beyond an F-18 in a Red Bull aircraft?
It's actually not as many as most people think. I've probably got about 6,500 hours total. Now, if you compare that to an airline pilot, airline pilots have 20,000 to 30,000 hours in their career. But I guess the interesting thing with my flying is they're generally all flights of much less than an hour, and in fact they're getting shorter as time goes on. With the air racing, you know, the average flight's between 6 and 10 minutes really.
There's a quality and quantity thing here, though, isn't there? You know, an airliner flying from Perth to London, the new route, is probably doing a lot less, actually, sort of hands on the joystick than you'd do in 15 minutes in a Red Bull race.
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, with almost all of the flying I've done, we don't use autopilots. You know, I'd say there's a couple of hundred hours of flying I've done on autopilots. But you know, when you look at the aircraft and the types of flying I do, you know, when you're flying a fighter, you're not sitting there dropping weapons while sitting on the autopilot. Obviously racing and aerobatics and then all those things. You're hands on flying rather than sitting there being systems management on an autopilot.
Mm. 6,500 hours. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, and the high tempo nature of the type of flying that you have been doing in uniform and out of uniform. And Malcolm Gladwell talks about this quantitative amount of 10,000 hours in order to be an expert. So, in his theory, you still haven't quite hit your best.
Yeah, well, I guess I've heard the 10,000 hour theory as well, but I think it's more 10,000 cycles of doing something. So an hour in my life is quite a bit different, because for one 10 minute flight in the air race, there's probably 10 hours of preparation for that 10 minutes. So I guess you'd look at it as, whether it's, when you're fine tuning what I do, it's more than just being in the cockpit. And it's, the number of events has well and truly exceeded 10,000, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Gladwell actually is paraphrasing a guy called Anders Ericsson, who came up with that original philosophy in that 10,000-hour figure, which is often misquoted because it is talking about deliberate practice. It's not just talking about rote cycles of getting time up. It's talking about that focused practice at getting better at different things. And that, in your context, Matt, I imagine would be on the ground and in the air as well. So exactly as you say, it's not just that stick time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how it was in the military as well. I had a pretty successful career in the military, and that was based on the fact that I did a huge amount of preparation and visualization for every single flight. And I think that was one of the key factors in my career in the Air Force.
So let's talk about the Air Force, Matt. I've had colleagues in the Army context who had thousands of rotary wing hours and then failed military pilot's course. Did you find that having a bunch of flying time before you hit pilot's course was a help, or did you have to unlearn some habits to fly in a military context?
I've witnessed the same thing where people with a lot of experience fail military training, and that's... There can be some bad, well, not bad, there can be some habit patterns that are different to the way the military want to do it, that become too hard for the individual to break. I had probably, I'd guess maybe between 100 and 150 hours when I joined the Air Force. So what I had with those 100 to 150 hours is I basically just had a bit of air sense. I didn't really have seriously ingrained habit patterns with that amount of flying. So I was still very moldable. And because I was quite young too, I was still in my teens when I was flying in the military. You know, I had big eyes and big ears and did a lot of listening and a lot of nodding and just did everything I was asked to do. Rather than if you're a bit more mature in life, you know, you're in your mid-20s and you've got a couple of thousand hours, you're probably going to have, you know, your ears probably won't be as big and your mouth is going to be a bit bigger. So that's where it turns into a problem.
And obviously this was a pretty successful run for you. As I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you were ducks on your pilot's course, your Hornet conversion, your fighter combat instructor course. You were the 1997 Fighter Pilot of the Year, which is a pretty cool title, I reckon. Right. And you also got a Chief of Air Force commendation for your performance as a chief instructor on the fighter combat instructor course. Hard work, talent, luck, you know, what's the mixture that gives you such a stellar run?
I would say that there is some natural ability in my flying. You know, you'd be crazy to say that I haven't got ability there, but it's definitely hard work as well. You know, I've instructed and worked with people who are natural pilots. But if they don't put in the hours it doesn't matter how natural you are, flying is much more than just flying with the stick and the rudder. It's all about making sure that you know the rules, you know the regulations, you know how your aircraft systems work, so that when something is going wrong, you're dealing with it very efficiently with knowledge of the systems. And it doesn't matter how good you are as a natural pilot, if you don't know the systems like the back of your hand, you're going to end up suffering and possibly being unsuccessful in your endeavors.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds like you had a bit of natural ability, maybe a bit of genetic ability through the years. Tell me, Robbo reflected on spending time crying in the toilets during during pilot course. Did you ever experience that, Matt?
No, I'll have to put that one in my pocket the next time I catch up with him. I actually really enjoyed my pilot training. I was fortunate that I started off well in my pilot training, and I think a lot of things you do in life, if you're doing a course or something, if you get off to a good start, your life is a lot easier because people kind of look at you differently. They're like, "Oh, this guy knows what he's doing, and let's cut him some slack." If you start off in the back foot, everyone's looking at you like, we need to keep an eye on this person, keep the microscope on them to see how they're going. So I think I had a little bit of flex there that I started well and continued to do well, to the point where I was never concerned, you know, from my memory, I was never concerned whether I was going to pass pilot's course or not. But apparently, like with all the people I know who've done pilot's course, that's not very common at all. Most people have, like at some stage during their training, they're concerned about whether they're actually going to pass the course, and that's a massive thing. Most people are in their early 20s, like late teens, early 20s, while they're doing this, and to be having the fear that you've got your dream shot, you know, like the Top Gun side things. Yeah. They've been given their dream shot, but if they blow it, that's it. And then that can put a lot of, impose a lot of self-induced pressure, which leads to stress and which ultimately actually leads to lower performance of the individual. So I think I was able to snowball, my good start to then go, man, this is awesome. I'm loving this. And every day I loved it more and more, which then generally had me do better and better because I was loving it more and more. So
A virtuous cycle.
Exactly. So rather than spiraling out of control, I spiraled into a positive mind frame, and as far as I can tell, one of the rare people on pilot's course that actually really enjoyed doing it.
So Ben mentioned Robbo being Tim Robertson, the chronic overachiever, and we've recorded an episode with Tim previously where he described you as a natural, and I'm not sure that flying an aircraft is a hereditary skill. You talk about all of the effort that you went into. I've also got another friend called Ben, unrelated to this particular Ben, and he was flying military transport aircraft and decided he wanted to do a conversion to fighters, to F-18s, and he failed the course. And I asked him the question, what made you fail the course? What was so challenging about it? And he gave me this answer that's always just stuck. He said, I couldn't think faster than the jet was moving. So, Matt, how do you think faster than the jet's moving?
It's something you build up on. If someone just jumps in a fighter doing 600 knots and you've never done it before, there's no way in the world your brain's going to work at the same pace as the aircraft. It's all going to happen way too quickly for you. But if you're building up to it and you're working hard, you can do it. So. It does take a certain amount of a certain brain to be able to do it. Once again, I think the preparation at home of being very methodical about what's going to happen on the flight and breaking it down into time, not distance, is a big thing for an F-18. Because if you're coming from the transport world, if you're 10 miles away from the airport, you're thinking along the lines of, hey, I've got a good 3 minutes before I get there. Whereas in a Hornet, if you're 10 miles away, you've got 1 minute. So if you've been used to thinking, oh, I'm 10 miles away, I'm going to start my checks now, it's going to go horribly wrong. Whereas if you think I'm 3 minutes away from the airfield, I'll start my checks, it's going to go a lot better. But you just have to get used to the fact that you've just got to project yourself a lot further forward in distance, but the time is, a set of checks takes the same amount of time. You just got to be prepared. You're going to travel a lot more distance doing it.
And transitioning out of Air Force, what motivated that decision and how simple was the transition, Matt?
I'd done quite a bit in the Air Force, as I was coming to the end of my career. I was, I'd set myself some objectives when I joined the Air Force that, I wanted to fly fighters as an objective. I wanted to do our Top Gun course, which I did both of those items. And then it was like, okay, what do I want to do now? I set myself a massive dream and I achieved it and I was still in my 20s. It's like, okay.
What next?
Is this the plateau? What happens now? But the Air Force was then, I managed to get myself an exchange program where I went to the United States and flew F-15s for 3 years and ended up actually flying in combat operations and came back out of that to Australia to fly the Hornet again. And I was really then kind of left in a bit of a quandary. It's like, so now I've done everything I can to Hornet. I've been and lived in another country, flown another jet, been in combat. I'm back on the Hornet again. I was thinking, what's my next big challenge? And I'd sort of been thinking that I'd love to have a challenge that's outside of fighters, but still in aviation. And I was thinking about, world aerobatic championships and things like that, just to push myself a bit harder in a different domain of aviation. And it just so happened while I was thinking about this, the Red Bull Air Race came along out of nowhere. And it's like, hey, it's kind of like this thing's built for me. I've been successful in one area of aviation, flying fighters and, under very high pressure situations. And now there's this competition which involves high speed, low level flight, lots of G and a lot of stress in competition. I was like, well, maybe that's where we need to be looking as the next challenge. So it was, I wasn't sick of the Air Force. I was still enjoying it, still very proud of everything I did there. And I highly recommend that career to anyone who asks, but it was just time for me to pick up a new challenge in life in a different aviation spectrum.
So, Matty, what is Red Bull Air Racing?
Oh, it's a way of life for me, actually. I live and breathe it now. So it's basically, you've got 14 pilots that travel the world in a world championship. Think Formula One, basically, that you've got the same guys and you've got your teams and we turn up at different locations around the world and we race. And you get points at the end of the race with your ranking, and then it, at the end of the year, the person with the most points is crowned the world champion. So the best form of aviation I've ever been involved in, and you know, that's probably saying something when you look at what I've done in aviation. So it's I quite often say that apart from the guys that walked on the moon, I'm the luckiest retired fighter pilot there has ever been.
And so the actual machines, can you tell us a bit about those? They're obviously bound by some sort of restrictions, some sort of commonality, but what type of aircraft are they, and what are the limitations or the capabilities?
Yes, so the aircraft, the race is still evolving, but it's getting pretty fine-tuned now. So when the race first started about 15 years ago, there was just a bunch of guys bringing along their aerobatic aircraft and flying around the pylons and seeing who went fastest. These aircraft have now developed into dedicated race planes. So, once again, you think of it like any motorsport, like Formula One, where there are guys that were just getting in the open wheelers, and they've turned into what they are. Mm. Same with V8 supercars. There were guys that were just turning up with their Taranas off the street. They'd drive them to Bathurst and then race them.
Yeah.
And now they're unique.
It's evolved.
Similar sort of thing. So our planes are governed by a set of sporting regulations, which makes sure that everything is safe, because obviously competition can drive people to do things that maybe not deliberately, but can lead to unsafe practices, because you start trimming corners and making things lighter or making things so it's faster, but it hasn't got the stall protection you'd like. Mm. But in the end, these aircraft, the engines are governed to what we can do to them. So we're pulling about 320, 330 horsepower out of these engines, but the aircraft themselves only weigh a bit over 500 kilos empty, and they weigh about 690 kilos as we're taking off to go into the race. So they've got the power-to-weight ratio of a Formula One car. With these planes, we can, straight and level, we can do well over 450 kilometres an hour. In the track, we're touching 400 kilometres an hour in the racetrack. A Formula One car corners at about 4G. An F-18 corners at 7.5G. Our planes can corner at 12G. So we're much more manoeuvrable than anything out there. In fact, our race planes, they're the most manoeuvrable pieces of machinery in the world to carry a human being. There's nothing else in the world that a human being gets into that manoeuvres as aggressively as these race planes.
Fascinating, isn't it? The contrast there from Formula One to an F-18 to the machine that you're flying now. So, Matt, everyone thinks of flying a Red Bull Air Racer as a solo sport. How important is the team that you have around you?
The team is critical. There's absolutely no way that you can be successful in this sport without the team there. People don't see the team as much as, say, Formula One, because we don't do pit stops. We don't do fast pit stops, so that it's not a timed thing. But we do three flights on race day, so we are turning the plane around. People don't see that everyone sort of jumping on it and doing everything in a high pressure environment. But everyone in the team's under pressure. We've got the team manager who's making sure that everyone is in the right place at the right time. All the boxes are ticked before we go flying and all the checklists are being completed. You've got your engineer who's making sure the plane is first and foremost safe, but also that it's compliant with all the rules and regulations so that we're not disqualified, and also that all of our speed mods have been done correctly, and then any extra mods we're doing are progressing. We've also got our tactician who's analysing all the data from engine data to me as the pilot, to where we are in the track, what our line is, what our G is, what our speed is, what the propeller's doing, etc. And then we have, outside of that, we have more staff back home that's a sports psychologist. We have a personal trainer, and we have a team of people back home actually just making sure that the media and the backup aircraft are all in shape. So there's absolutely no way that, because it's a funny position I'm in, because I'm the team owner, but also the athlete. So I've got to be able to very clearly and consciously take off my business hat and put on my sports hat, so that I can focus purely on myself when I'm racing and not be worrying at all about, you know, are the airfares booked? Have we made sure that the bills are being paid? All that sort of stuff.
Matt, my father was a military pilot, helicopter pilot, and he used to have a plaque on the wall that said, "Flying is like the sea. While not inherently dangerous, it can be extremely unforgiving." Now, you're taking flying, obviously, to pretty much the furthest level that humans can. Do you consider it dangerous?
I consider it unforgiving. Yeah. So I don't consider it dangerous. Flying is one of those activities that you make it as dangerous as you want. I could go and get a plane out right now and do something and make it dangerous before I even take off. Just by not being sensible in what I'm doing, not being prepared. But with what I do with racing, people look at that and think I'm an adrenaline junkie. They think that I'm a risk taker, but I'm not. I'm actually probably one of the most boring people you'll ever meet as far as taking risk is concerned, because I don't do anything off the cuff. I sit down, sit through and plan and visualize and then brainstorm contingencies and what ifs before I'll do anything that involves getting in an aircraft. I don't snow ski. I don't skydive. I own a motorbike, but I ride it like a scooter, even though it's a 1,000cc engine. All these things, I'm actually pretty sedate as a person because, I know that what I'm doing doesn't have a lot of margin, and it's the margin which is keeping me safe. So the less margin you've got, the more disciplined you have to be in knowing exactly where you are within that margin.
And Matt, what about near misses? So we talk about risk. In 2010, your aircraft touched water on the Detroit River during a wing stall. I think there's actually some footage of that. Can you talk to us about what raises your heart rate beyond just flying fast in those near miss situations?
Yeah, it's actually if you have a near miss, but you're a well prepared person, you don't actually even raise your heartbeat in those events. As it's happening, in fact, if you're a well-prepared person, as things are going wrong, time slows down because you actually enter a form of temporal distortion where your brain actually accelerates and you start rapidly assessing all of your options extremely quickly. Mm. And you actually get to just watch everything occurring in slow motion. And it seems like you got all the time in the world, even to make the assessment. In that particular case where I crashed the plane, I remember probably a good 30 to 40 decisions I made in that process and thoughts I had. And the whole thing lasted about 0.6 of a second. So it doesn't really raise your heart doing that. The only thing that really raises your heart is worrying about what's going to happen. The actual doing it and even near misses, with what I'm doing, you don't even have time to worry. You just have to deal with what you're faced with right here and right now.
But that said, you've done some parachute jumps, I understand.
I've done one.
Well, you probably only need to do one, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. I've done one just to see what it's like, and I prefer landing them.
Well, Ben and I might have a little bit more time under canopy than you do in that regard.
I love all forms of aviation, and skydiving is something I've always looked at, but it once again is one of those things that I can't afford to twist an ankle or anything like that. So I'm kind of wrapped in cotton wool these days, unfortunately.
There's also that old saying about the lunacy of jumping out of a perfectly good airplane, which as a pilot probably rings true.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt, you mentioned before with the pilot's course that, doing well and getting that virtuous circle or cycle going was an important component of your military success. How have you dealt with failure? I assume somewhere in there there's been failures. How have you sort of rebounded from those? What tactics do you use to get over that and learn from it?
So I had a pretty good run where I didn't have too much go wrong for probably the first 5 years or 3 years of my career. And then I had my first bad ride. Like the first flight I failed ever, was probably about 3 years into, 3 or 4 years into my career. And then everyone had a bit of a laugh and went, oh, you know, it was bound to happen. It's considerate character building. I thought, you know, that's bullshit. That's character building.
I failed. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was hard to take, but you know, what I have realized since is, you know, that failures do occur in life, and you've actually got to not be scared of failure, because if you're scared of failure, you'll actually not stick your neck out and try to do things beyond your comfort zone. So what I do now is, you know, I'm quite often, you know, got my neck stuck at, you know, I'm competing in front of, you know, millions and millions of people worldwide, you know, trying to win a race. And, you know, I've crashed a plane doing it, and I've hit pylons, and, you know, you go from being the hero to zero in a split second.
Yeah.
And that's failure. But what you've got to do is I've realized is you've got to keep going back to what is the dream, and you know, make sure that you've got a dream on the wall that that is where is the reason you're doing it, or is where you're heading, so that if something goes wrong, don't look at the right here and now, get lessons from it, but then file it away and look back up on the wall and go, but that's why I'm doing it, and that's where I'm going, and this is all worth it. So you go, right, that's part of the learning cycle, that's part of the journey. I learned from it, and it makes me stronger now to achieve that dream.
It's funny. There's a researcher named Carol Dweck who talks about having a growth mindset, where you're open to pushing beyond your comfort zone, to trying something and potentially failing. And the opposite of that is a thing called a fixed mindset, where a lot of successful people find themselves. They're so used to being viewed as successful that it increases their perceived risk of trying something new and failing. And it sounds like you've overcome that you're willing to take a chance, you're willing to fail, you're willing to sort of deviate from that fixed mindset. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, I did feel myself getting trapped into that you know, before I had that first failed flight as an Air Force guy, I found that I was getting more and more nervous at every flight and enjoying it less and less, because yeah, when I was pushing it, I was like, well, maybe I'm going to be the one that gets shot down in this training mission, or I'm going to be the one that doesn't get his bombs off in this training mission, because you know, what if I make a mistake and then good runner's over, and then there's no point anymore if the good runner's over. And you know, I started not enjoying it and actually not wanting to go on the bigger missions just in case it all went wrong. And then when I did fail at it, it was like, okay, you know, that's a good lesson for me that, you know, my life didn't stop. No one laughed at me. They all shrugged their shoulders and said, yeah, that's part of the process. And then I became okay doing it.
Well, I think I've discovered the one thing I've beaten you at. I've failed a lot earlier and a lot more times than you throughout my career. So, I guess I learned that lesson a bit earlier.
Matt, business owner, Red Bull athlete, you've got to have a personal life in there as well. What does a day in the life of Matt Hall look like? What's your routine?
Oh, there's probably not so much of a big routine, actually, because it's so varied what I do. But yeah, typically I try and exercise twice a day. Doing stretches in the morning is absolute necessity with how my body is abused. There's almost always some responses for fans and media.
We know you only select the best options to do media with.
Exactly. Yeah. Here we are. There's almost always some business proposals that are put in front of me that I've got to, disregard or say we'll have a look at. And then also, just looking at the health of the aircraft, the health of me, and what training am I doing, whether I'm doing mental training, physical training, or flying training. But there's generally going to be some form of training each and every day as well.
So in the moments before you jump into the cockpit to fly a Red Bull Air Race, how do you focus? Is there tools that you use? Is there anything in the mindfulness realm that you reach for?
Definitely. I've got my own little, I've got my own sports psychologist, and I've got my own routines that I follow. And I also have my own little tricks that I use to calm my brain down, because it's all about being at peace basically as you compete. and focusing on yourself and no one else. And I think every athlete learns, every successful athlete learns what works best for them. There's no right or wrong way of sports psychology, but I definitely have routines and disciplines that I use that I know work for myself.
Without giving away your competitive edge, can you share some of those with us, or are they very personal and secret?
Oh no, there's one of the biggest things is actually just complete routine discipline, making sure that you're following a routine to the minute. For me, so that's my military way, is never worrying about what's going to be happening in the future, just because I know that it will work if I do what I've got to do right now. Other things is just deep breathing, circular breathing, just clearing the mind by deep breathing, stretching, exercising, and then eyes closed visualization of success. You've got to visualize success to make it happen.
In the visualization, do you see the race before you race it? Do you fly the course before you fly it?
Definitely, yeah. That's a given, an absolute must. And I think all the race pilots do the same thing. I think, in fact, almost all athletes do that these days. Is a strong visualization of just going through real time, basically with your eyes closed, seeing if you can nail a 55 second run, seeing if you can nail that in your own mind to 55 seconds, just so that you are very clear in your mind what's going to happen on the perfect run, so that if you start to deviate from the perfect run, you see it straight away and react very quickly, as opposed to coming off the rails before you realize that you're not on the perfect run anymore.
It's funny you mentioned that discipline and the military style checks leading up to an event as a way of dispelling that nervous energy. Tim mentioned parachuting before, and one of the things you do in an aircraft before you're about to jump out is these final checks of equipment, and you go through a very ritualistic process. And I remember thinking during our training, like, this is silly. We've already been checked 15 times. And then I recognise that it's actually not about checking that your parachute's strapped on correctly. It's about focusing your mind on something you can control to give you power over that nervous energy, and before you know it, you're out the door without even thinking about jumping out of a plane. And I think that transfers well into a lot of things. If you can actually control or focus your mind on things you can control, then it can really help to dispel that nervous energy.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So 400 to 450 kilometres an hour pulling 12G, what toll does that take on the body, Matt?
If you're not in perfect shape, it can damage you. My body is always sore. There's no doubt about that. I've had back surgery once already in my life. The discs aren't designed to pull that amount of chi, really. But we're getting better at doing it. We're learning as we go. The guys doing the air racing, we're the first generation of people pulling this amount of G. And we're learning how to do it. We're learning how to make sure our core strength is supporting our lumbar spine. We're learning how not to move our head when we're pulling lots of G. I tell my wife quite often that when I die, I donate my body to science and see what the hell happened in there.
I assume there's a good physio and or a chiro in your life.
Yeah, there's a number of them, actually. On the race, we have an osteopath that's with us at the race. And then when I'm at home, I've got a physio, a chiro, and a masseuse that I'm pretty familiar with.
So in your rookie year, you finished on the podium. And in 2015, 2016, and 2018, you placed second. What's it going to take for you to get from second to the very top of the podium?
Nothing different to what we're doing now, really. I think the consistency is there. For a couple of those world championships where I've come second, it's been a flip of a coin at the end as to who was the world champion. The machinery is so well controlled through rules, the machines are about the same. You know, there's subtle differences in some of the machinery, but they're about the same. So in the end, you know, it's just going to be who's the most consistent pilot throughout the year. And while I've been second three times, each time it's been a different person that's beaten me as well. So in some ways, I've actually been the most consistent pilot out there.
Yeah.
It's just unfortunate that the you know, every time I come second, there's someone else that sticks their head above water and then they go under again.
Do you believe in luck, Matt?
Not really. I believe in hard work and tenacity leads to results.
Yeah. There's a saying, you make your own luck. I reckon that's often the case when I look back on things where it seems to have been a lucky break. You know, when you unpack it, there's often, like you said, that years and years of hard work, that consistency, the sort of the continuous effort that leads to it.
And some preconditions to luck, perhaps.
Mm.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, people often call me lucky because I get to do what I'm doing. And for me, I'm fortunate that I get to do what I'm doing, but it's not luck. It's basically investing in myself, taking some risk, and using my potential with an opportunity that I went looking for, and holding them together as tight as possible through thick and thin to have the result I've got that a lot of people call luck.
So Matt, I've got to ask this question. The podcast would not be complete if I didn't. What keeps you grounded?
My son. he watches me and just shakes his head and says, "Yeah, you're just my dad. Don't let it."
That's beautiful.
We've both got those at this end as well. How old is he?
He's 13 now, but he's been watching me do this all of his life. And one of the funniest things is when he was about 6 or 7, he came home from school one day and said, "Jasper's family's really poor." And I said, "Oh, why is that, mate?" And he goes, "Because they don't even own one plane." You've got a bit of a warped sense of norm here.
Is he now involved in your flying life as well?
He used to fly a bit with me. He's not doing that much flying with me at the moment. But, yeah, it's one of those things that as you're growing up, you know, interests come and go. So we don't push it at all and let him choose when he wants to fly.
Matt, looking to the future, obviously in the military realm, we're seeing a lot of UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, drones coming in and in more and more capacities of military flight. Do you see that there'll always be a role for the person in the cockpit?
I do. There'll be some types of flying that doesn't, which we're already seeing, but there's always going to be pilots because it's just what people want to do as well. You know, there's it's not just a job. It's a desire.
Yeah.
So there'll always be people in the cockpit.
Yeah.
Matt, we take inspiration from a number of poems, one being Rudyard Kipling's If, another being a famous James Elroy Flecker poem, which talks about always going a little further. It certainly seems like you've always gone a little further in your life. What sparks that fire? What drives you to always take those one step in front of the other?
I think a little bit of an addiction to improving things, and yeah, what I've realized over time is what I enjoy is actually improving efficiencies, making anything more efficient, and secondly, making things grow. So what that means with the efficiency side of things is no matter what I do or what I'm involved in, I'm always looking at a way to make it more efficient, and more efficient, whether that's you know, it's using less energy or using less money or going further with what we're putting into it. I enjoy that. And that can be business, and that generally goes hand in hand with my my desire to have things grow. And I guess what both of those items come down to is I'm not content with status quo. I'm always looking for improvement, and improvement is going that extra mile.
Matt, we desperately want to see you on the very, very top of the podium, and we wish you all the best for the racing season. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Cheers, man.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own Unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers.